The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised. Hey everybody, welcome to this interview episode of Thinking Outside the Long Box. On the line today, I have Ezra Clayton Daniels. He is the author of Upgrade Soul. It's a multiple award-winning graphic novel, including Pace Magazine's number one graphic novel of 2018, the Dwayne McDuffie Award for Diversity in Comics, and the Dinky Award for Diversity in Comics. Ezra, how are you doing today, man?
Yeah, doing great. It's a great morning in Los Angeles and ready to get this day started.
Right on. Well, I'm glad we could be the start to your day as opposed to the end of a very long day or something like that. So the first thing I want to ask about Upgrade Soul is kind of what is the impetus behind it? Like, it seems like a very, you know, body horror, transhuman, you know, deep dive into like kind of psychological ideas. Like, how did you come to write this graphic novel?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on in the book. It mostly comes from inspiration, the stuff I was really into. So a lot of my inspirations are like David Cronenberg, a lot of like 80s sci-fi and horror, like RoboCop is a big influence. So there's a lot of referencing stuff like that in there. The basic idea for the story is kind of inspired by my first year of going away to art school. So I grew up in a small town in Iowa called Sioux City, Iowa, and I was always kind of known as the, like, you know, I was an art kid in my hometown. I was like the best artist and writer, and I was kind of like the big fish in like the teen art scene in my hometown. And so when I moved away to go to art school in Portland, Oregon, I was suddenly faced with a bunch of people who were better at everything that I thought I was the best at. And that prospect of being made obsolete by people who were better at the things that I identified myself as, was something that was like a weird thing for me to grapple with. I think a lot of people, I have a lot of friends who are kind of, you know, precocious teens and then went off to college and then realized that they weren't as smart as they thought they were. So I was kind of like starting with that as a nugget of like the seed of a horror story. And then I built that out into this crazy body horror transhumanist epic.
So with the characters in the novel, you're dealing with an elderly couple who have decided to get a rejuvenation to make themselves younger. Like, how do you enter the headspace of an elderly person when you're not elderly? Just, you know, how do you approach kind of that mindset?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's a lot of sort of transposing my experiences into other people's experiences by finding the commonality between those experiences. So I think the thing that worked for me in trying to transpose this story that, like I said, was born in my transition from being a teenager to a young adult as I was like 19, 20 years old, transposing that into the experience of someone who's like 65 and experiencing a transition from being like a working person to a retiree, I realized the corollary was just like, those are two huge life transitions. Like, those are two of the biggest life transitions that human beings will face in their lives. And so I realized that a lot of the things I was feeling when I was 19 and 20, when I originally came up with the idea, I'm 40 now. So I worked on the story for like 15 years. And over the course of working on that, it became a lot better. It became vastly better than it was when I started working on it. But the core of the idea was this idea of transition. And that was something that I could see in my grandparents, who were the main inspirations for the two main characters of the story. And so that was something that we had in common that I could see.
So working on the novel for such a long time, did the story like blossom or like change in any way, like as you matured with the story?
Yeah, it changed a lot. Like the core nugget of the story never changed. And I always knew the beat that I wanted to end on. So the ending of the story never changed, but how I got from the premise to the end changed greatly over the course of the 15 years that I was working on it. I think like you just said, like I became a much better person. I became a more constant, thoughtful person. I became a more woke person. I became a better writer. I became better at structuring stories and building character arcs. So over the course of that decade and a half, I went back, rewrote huge sections of the book, totally revamped characters and changed a lot. I changed a lot of the art, the character design. So it definitely went through a lot of permutations over those, over the course of the time that I worked on it. And that was one of the reasons, why it took so long for me to do, because, you know, I'd work on it for a few years, take a couple of years off to work on other projects, then come back to it as a better artist and realize that there was a lot of stuff that I could have done better. And I had luxury because it was a project I was self-funding. I didn't have an editor breathing down my neck telling me to get this done. I had the luxury to be like, okay, if I could have done this better, then I'm going to take the time to redo it, to do it. So it's at the best of my capabilities that I'm at now.
So when you're looking at like the overall process, being able to do this book, like kind of independently without a publisher, you know, as you said, breathing down your neck, what are some of like the benefits and drawbacks of that? Cause there have to be benefits to working with a publisher as well.
Yeah. Working with the publisher is, my experience working with the publisher is not typical. So I can't really, the benefits as I see it to working with the publisher is that I don't have to store the entire print run of books in my house. I don't have to worry about fulfilling orders to retailers and customers. That's a huge thing. There's a publicity end that's a benefit to working with the publisher. Well, I don't have to field email inquiries for reviews or interviews or whatever, and they're out there like trying to pound the pavement to get people to write about the story. And so before I did Upgrade Soul, I self-published a book called The Changers. That was a 200-page science fiction graphic novel that I put out when I was like 23. And I did that 100% by myself. I worked with the printers to get it printed up. I stored the books. I shipped all the books to all, for every order. I got distribution through Diamond. So I dealt with Diamond, went through that whole process. I did publicity on my own. I organized a cross-country book tour to promote it. And so that was my experience of doing stuff on my own. And the advantage that I could see of doing it on my own was that I had total control over every aspect of everything, not only the story and the way it looked and the, you know, having complete control over the story I wanted to tell, but also like the way the story was presented to the world. And that was important. That was really cool. And you know, I was young and I had the time and necessarily want to do that again. There's definitely pluses and minuses, but with Upgrade Soul, when I found a publisher to put Upgrade Soul out, the book was already done. So I never had the experience of working with an editor, where an editor was telling me, or like advising me on things to do to change the story. So the book was done. I pitched it to Lion Ford and they basically just signed off on it. So I never had to make any editorial changes. So that's what I mean when I say my experience with a publisher wasn't typical.
That's awesome. It's kind of like you got the best of both worlds in that particular situation.
Yeah, totally.
So there is an app for the novel that allows you to kind of watch a partially animated version of it. Is that kind of how I understand the app to work?
Well, it's not animated. So it's kind of a complicated story, but working on Upgrade Soul for a really long time, and every few years I would try to pitch to publishers, and nobody wanted to touch the book. This was like, Upgrade Soul began with like a decade and a half of rejection. So the fact that it's getting like accolades and awards now is such a huge vindication for not giving up on this story, because nobody wanted to touch it for years. And a friend of mine named Eric Lawyer, he's an experimental digital artist and a developer. He started playing around with this platform that he had an idea for. It was an interactive comics reader platform for iOS. And this was in the early days of iOS. It was like for the first generation of iPad. So nobody had done anything like this before. So he asked me, as his friend who makes comics, if I wanted to do something for the platform. And just by virtue of having no other outlet for Upgrade Soul at the time, this was like in 2010, I jumped on the opportunity. It sounded super cool. I really like working with Eric, and I love like new technology and new frontiers. And so I thought it was a really fun challenge. So Eric and I worked together on developing Upgrade Soul in 2010 as an interactive iOS app. So we launched it in 2012. The idea was for it to be a serialized story. We'd launch a new chapter every few months, because I'd only drawn like 30 pages of the book by then. So I had just started on that book. So we're going to launch a new chapter every couple of months and then collect it all at the end and try to find a print publisher for the book when it was done. Sorry, this is a really long, complicated story.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
You can edit it out in post. But so what happened was we got about halfway through updating the chapters, and the revenue for the app just wasn't what we were hoping it would be for like technology to catch up, because not a lot of people were using iPads at the time. This is, like I said, in the really early days of iPads. And certainly there weren't a lot of comics people and artists that were using iPads, because Comixology wasn't a thing yet and Procreate wasn't a thing yet. So it was still a really niche project. So we put the thing on hold. I kept working on the book. I finished the book and then sold it to a publisher. And then the book came out and got a lot of accolades and got a lot of attention. And so we decided to go back and finish the app and relaunch it, which launches on Friday, February 25th, which is today for me. But whenever this goes live, it might be a few days ago or a week ago.
So when, you know, when you're working through the app and you're kind of, you know, gauging that it's not going to be so effective, you know, in the past, obviously. And then you see now that, you know, the book's gotten a ton of accolades. People are very excited about it. And you relaunch the app. Do you think the catching up of technology is like something that in a lot of weird ways, the book speaks to as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's definitely thematically on point for us to have a groundbreaking digital comics reader app associated with Upgrade Soul. And I think there's a lot of, Upgrade Soul is a very thoughtful book, and it's thoughtful partly because I had the luxury of spending so much time with it. So I could go back and add layers and add like intellectual ideas on top of it in a way that a lot of comics artists don't have the luxury to do because they're on deadlines. I think it's like a lot of it is that simple. But with Upgrade Soul, the app, Eric and I took a very serious intellectual and philosophical approach to making comics digitally. And so we wanted to create something that felt fundamentally like reading a comic. But something that utilized the technological advances of the devices. So things like animation and voice acting and literal sound effects, we did not want to do, because we feel like when digital comics use things like that, it makes the comic feel like a crappy animation rather than reading a comic. Like as soon as you, like if there's a button, a digital comic, that's like a play button and you press play and you're watching an animation, then for that stretch of time, it doesn't feel like you're reading a comic. It feels like you're watching a video. So we came up with this whole manifesto. There's actually the manifesto became the central feature of a website called Screen Diver. It's www.screendiver.com, which is kind of like an IMDb for digital. You want to see other people, see other experiments that people are doing in this space. So yeah, it was something that we took really seriously. Sorry, that was another super long answer.
No, it's okay. Your long answers are normal answers, just so you know. What's great about like our format is that I get to like ask you questions because I'm just interested. Like if you feel like you're on point, then you're on point. You never need to apologize for your answers.
Okay, cool. I've been doing so many panels in the past year because so Upgrade Soul came out in September, and I had another book called Bottom Feeders that came out from Fantagraphics in June. And I've been doing like the whole tour of all of the indie comics festivals for like a year. And I've been on so many panels that I'm becoming so conscious of how long I'm talking when someone asks a question, even when it's directed directly at me, because I'm just like, in the back of my mind, I'm always trying to think about, oh, there's four other people on this panel. I got to leave them space to answer questions too.
Like, oh no, I'm chewing up panel time. Yeah. Don't worry. Totally. It's just you and me. And if I go long, it doesn't change anything. So.
Okay. Awesome. Good to know.
So one thing I'm really interested in, your novel came out and it just received accolades like kind of across the board last year. I mean, it's gotten, you know, best books from like Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, Vulture, like all sorts of different places. How does that feel? And like, how does that change how you feel about your artistic process?
It feels awesome. Obviously, it feels, like I said, it feels very vindicating. It feels, I'm a petty person. I'm just going to put that out there. And so like the fact that I was rejected for 15 years for this book, and then to have it come out and then for me to be getting like emails from the exact same people that rejected me, congratulating me on the book success, like that feels amazing. Like for the book to like be featured on Pace as like the best graphic novel of the year, like part of me just wants to like send that link to the editors at the comics publishers that told me there wasn't going to be an audience for this book. I think part of the reason the book the book found an audience when it did was because the industry is finally catching up to the idea that diversity is valuable in the marketplace, which is a thing like for years, the common wisdom was that if it doesn't appeal to 18 and 35 year old white males, then it's not a sellable book, which is a thing that's like baffling to me because it's totally not true, but it just became a thing that, everybody accepted as gospel. So I think due to the success of things like Get Out, I point to Get Out as like a thing that opened up a lot of doors for me because suddenly people realized that there was space for not only diverse stories, but space for stories that use genre conventions to relay like really specific political agendas, which is not such a huge part of Upgrade Flow, but Bottom Feeders is really like exactly in that vein.
What I find interesting is like the mentality, like you said, Get Out is a good example of, in my opinion, the mainstream catching on to you can use genre film, genre fiction, genre comic books to like relay like a very specific message. When in reality, mm-hmm. like comics and movies and music have been doing that forever. It's just that nobody mm-hmm. caught on to it because the gatekeeper at the publishing house is saying, no, we have to appeal to this specific, you know, demographic. But in the 80s and 90s, the X-Men were 100% dealing with racial issues through the metaphor of mutants, you know? So it's interesting that there are so many people out there that think comics can't be one way when they've been that way the whole time. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a long history of using genre as a Trojan horse to disseminate political ideals. I think like the Twilight Zone is kind of the high watermark for that. And that was Rod Serling's entire intent, was because, you know, he was trying to write radio plays and television plays that addressed real social issues as he saw them. And nobody wanted to put the stuff out because they thought it was like too controversial. It was too provocative. Nobody was going to want to watch it. Nobody'd be entertained by it. So his idea was that he would recast the players in a race story as aliens or robots. And by doing that, the censors just like could no longer see what he was actually trying to say. But I think that his idea was like, hopefully that the public would be able to glean messages from that. And I think it's a long and powerful history that I'm certainly a part of and I certainly respect. But I do think that there's kind of a danger in obscuring your message through genre tropes, which is that it makes it a little bit harder for some people to understand the message if you've obscured it even a little bit. I think X-Men is a really good example of that because X-Men is designed as a race allegory, right? Like you said, the mutants are cast as people of color and the Sentinels, and I forget the agency's name that is against the Sentinels, is kind of like the oppressive white supremacist government. Right. And that's kind of like the underlying metaphor of the book. But in practice, especially the further you get from the original intent, like X-Men as a group is still 90% white and largely male. And even the characters that are people of color, like there was just a huge controversy a couple days ago about Storm, like the way they're coloring Storm in the current run of some X-Men comic was basically just like as a white woman. And it got a lot of backlash. But the problem is that like a lot of people, when they read a story like X-Men today, they see this cast of white people that are being oppressed by an oppressive government. And the lesson that they take from that isn't that governments are oppressing minorities, it's that governments are oppressing white people or white people that have like certain aspects that they deem, that the government deems dangerous. In this case, I think it's dangerous because that thing that the government might be deemed dangerous is like knowledge of the deep state conspiracy or something. You know what I mean? Like, right. So it becomes like really removed from the original intent, which I think can be dangerous.
You know, it's interesting. As soon as you put, you know, your message, your idea out into the public forum as like a piece of art, it becomes up for debate what it's about. You know,
right.
We just watched for the podcast, we just watched Midsommar, which is a really great mm-hmm. movie. But I got ideas and thoughts from it that the other guys on the podcast didn't necessarily see or pick up because my interpretation is different because it's effectively my personal opinion. Like you said, as soon as you obfuscate some of your ideas, it then becomes, well, is this what he means or is this what he means? And even if you go out into the public and say, no, this is exactly what I meant, people will be like, well, you know, he's just saying that. So it's an interesting conundrum.
Yeah. But that's why I point to Get Out as Get Out is my like platonic idea how to use genre as a way to candy coat important messages, because there's no way that you could take any message from Get Out other than the message that Jordan Peele wanted you to get, because he didn't recast the characters as a way to get past censors. And part of his luxury in doing that was because the censors aren't necessarily recast. They're not blocking things in the way that they were in the 60s. They're certainly still blocking things in terms of like, they won't produce something because they don't think it'll appeal to that 18 to 35 year old white market. But especially in comics, I think that's the great thing about comics is like, there's gatekeepers in comics, but like when you go to a show like SPX or CXC or TCAF, like there's nobody telling these zinesters and mini comics makers what they can and can't say in comics. So I think I love comics because comics, more than any other art form, is at the very, very front lines of ideas that you're going to be seeing breaking into the mainstream once the gatekeepers finally catch on that there's a market for stuff like this.
Do you think like leaning into like the marketability of comic books has the potential to like kind of distort the messages that people are trying to put into their books?
Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, absolutely. And I think as a creator, I definitely have no desire to ever do anything that's designed to sell. Because for that very reason, like what does that even mean? And what would that mean for, like, I can't even wrap my mind around what that would look like.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm still writing stories that are palatable. Because part of my intent was, especially part of my intent with having, political underpinnings to the stuff I do is that I want as many people to experience these stories as possible. I'm trying to reach as wide of an audience as possible because I want as many people to engage with my ideas as possible. And part of that is making this stuff palatable, at least to a degree. But as a creator, I find it more interesting to, I guess, play with the formulas rather than completely adhere to the formulas, if that makes sense. So I think if I was trying to make something that was like, going to reach an even wider audience than, like, not the upgrade still reached a wide audience. It's still a super niche book. But, like, if I wanted to disseminate those ideas to an even wider audience, then maybe I would have told it as, like, a superhero story with no characters of color.
Right.
I don't know.
Which would be a really tricky thing to pull off with this book, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
So talk to me a little bit about your new book, Bottom Feeders.
So Bottom Feeders is a book that I wrote, and it was illustrated by Ben Passmore, who is a white hot indie creator who did a book called Your Black Friend last year that was turned into an animation that went viral on YouTube. Bottom Feeders is a story about, it's kind of an allegory about cultural appropriation and gentrification. It's a story about these two art school girls who move to a blighted neighborhood on the south side of Chicago looking for cheap rent and discover that there's a symbiotic organism living within the walls of the building that is awakened when people start moving into the building because the organism in the building feeds off of the waste of the tenants. So as more people start moving into the building, the creature comes out of this state of dormancy and starts to terrorize people.
It sounds like a, it sounds super creepy, but also incredibly fascinating. working with another artist, you know, how was that interplay? Did you guys, you know, kind of challenge each other's ideas? You know, were you going back and forth about how things looked or came off or sounded as you were writing it?
It was my first time collaborating with an artist, and it was so easy. It was amazing. I loved, like, every part of the process was so much fun. And I think a big part of that was that Ben Passmore is an incredibly talented and accomplished and confident artist. So I wrote it in screenplay format because that's just how I learned how to write, even though it was intended to be a comic book eventually. I sent Ben a screen. And Ben, just by like harnessing his talents and wrapping his talents around this, turned it into something that was everything that I had hoped for and more. And it was in the back and forth process was was pretty minimal. Other than when we first started working on the book, I flew him to LA. He was living in New Orleans at the time. So I flew him out here and we had just like a week long intensive, like brainstorm session where we just like went through the story, talked about character designs and monster designs, watched a bunch of movies I was referencing in the story and that I felt like, and that he might've wanted to reference. And then I just like, he went back home and he just like ran with it. I didn't hear from him for 6 months. And then 6 months later, he sent me a stack of like 40 pencil pages. And I was just like, this is great. Keep going. And then he just kept going. And then like a couple years later, he finished the book and yeah, then we put it out.
That's awesome. And like, as you know, as a book that's published on Fantagraphics, like it immediately gets my attention because Fantagraphics creates like amazing books. You know, what was it like working with them as a company?
Oh, it was great. I mean, it was a dream come true. Like anybody who's making comics in the indie comic space dreams of working with Fantagraphics. So it was amazing to be given that opportunity. And as a publisher, they're keeping it real in a way that like I didn't think was possible anymore. Maybe partly by virtue of them being from Seattle, which is the origin of like of the grunge music scene. They're just like, their office is just like a shitty, crumbling Victorian house in a dumb neighborhood right off the highway in Seattle that's just like moldy and musty, and there's just like people crammed into every corner and it's stacked like inch to inch. It's like a hoarder house that's full of like the most amazing comics anybody's ever created. It's full of crazy artifacts, original art, and it's a super small company. Everybody is like, it's like a big family, and they're just like, it's an amazing testament of like what you can do if you're motivated by something other than profit, right, as a company.
It sounds like, perfect.
It's amazing. Like the production quality on Bottom Feeders was through the roof because they wanted to do something amazing. And compared to Upgrade Soul, like Upgrade Soul, it's a comic book, but like there's nothing special about the actual object of the book because Lionforge's bottom line was like, well, we're trying to keep costs down because we want to sell books, blah, blah, blah. It's all about profit. But the Fantagraphics are just like, we're going to do hardcover, spot gloss, like a weird size, anything you want. Sky's the limit. We just want this thing to be an amazing art object. So that's it was awesome. Like a really interesting experience to forge the Fantagraphics.
That's really cool to me. Like I've always kind of fantasized about what Fantagraphics would be like as like an organization, and you answered all of the questions I had. So
it's exactly, yeah, it was not a disappointment to go to the Fantagraphics headquarters.
So one last thing I want to ask you about Upgrade Soul is about the music. So for the app, you have like an integrated soundtrack. And of course, there's also like a playlist available to listen to. What is, you know, what was kind of the process of attaching the music to the comic book?
Yeah. So the main feature of the app is the score. And the idea with the score is that just like, so like I was saying before, the whole thing, our whole intent, Eric and I, was to create something that felt intrinsically like reading a comic book. And the main tenet of that is that everything that happens in the reading experience has to be controlled and tied to the reader's volition. So nothing should happen in the reading experience that isn't directly tied to the reader wanting it to happen. And a big part of that was the music. So the big thing with the music is that the music keeps perfect pace with your progress through the app. So as you're swiping through the panels, every panel triggers a change in the music, so the music keeps perfect pace with every emotional cue in every scene in the story. So it was a really complicated thing that Eric came up with, and part of that was working with a composer that understood what we were trying to do and was able to give us the flexibility with the songs for us to be able to wrap it into this technology. So I found a composer that was a old friend of mine from the underground DIY Chicago art and music scene. His name is Alexis Gideon. He's in a rap rock novelty art group called Princess that's touring right now. It's hard to describe what they do.
That is the most amazing genre description I think I've ever heard.
it's incredible. And Alexis is one of those, it saddened me that he wasn't a household name because he's just like a mega talent that nobody knows about. And it's just like a testament to how screwed up our culture is that guys like this aren't lauded in the way that they should be. So Alexis, just like Ben Passmore, who drew Bottom Feeders, I felt the exact same way about Ben. So these are two people that I met that I just fell in love with their work, and I wanted to work with them on something, and just like was desperate to find something to work on with them. So I hit up Ben, wanted to work on this book with me, and we just had a really similar musical aesthetic. Like, we both love Goblin, John Carpenter, Ennio Morricone, Steve Reich, Philip Glass. Like, we're all coming from the same kind of musical inspirations for what we had in mind for the Upgrade Soul score. So the way it worked with Alexis was that he would write a song for a scene. So I basically gave him a list of all the emotional themes that I wanted to hit for the soundtrack. And he would write a song to hit a theme like, I don't know, just say tension or something. It was more specific than that, but just say it was tension. And then he would write a song that was comprised of like 10 different tracks. So, you know, I mean, like, you know how music works. Like, a song is comprised of like a bunch of different layered tracks. So he would send us the individual tracks, call them stems. And then for Upgrade Soul, as you're going through the app, every panel would turn on and off different stems in each song. So we were able to get a ton of mileage out of every song, which is like a normal 3-minute song, just by virtue of turning on and off individual tracks. So if you imagine like your favorite pop song or whatever, if you imagine isolating just the guitar part of that song, it sounds like a completely different song. And it sounds like it has a completely different tone and vibe. So a song that like might be a really fun and poppy pop song, if you isolate just the strings and the guitar and play those two tracks together, it might sound like a really somber, thoughtful, sad song.
That's interesting. Like, that's a really cool way to approach it that I definitely would not have ever have thought of. So before I let you go, Ezra, can you let our listeners know how they can keep up with you and find out, you know, where you're going to be and the kind of things that you're getting ready to release? Because you are the kind of guy that I definitely want to keep an eye on in a not creepy sort of way.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm on Instagram, Ezra C. Daniels. I'm on all social media as at Ezra C. Daniels. Like I said, Upgrade Soul, the app, is available now. You can download that. It's a free download to check out the first chapter, and then you can unlock the entire book for $7 through the month of October, and after October, it'll be $8. So it's a fraction of the cost. For my money, objectively, it's a vastly more immersive reading experience. When you put your headphones and start swiping through the app, it's amazing as a reading experience. So that's out now. Feeders is out in stores everywhere. I have a new nonfiction political essay mini comic called Are You at Risk for Empathy Myopia, which is available through RadiatorComics.com. And I've got big, like, stratospherically huge announcements to make regarding Upgrade Soul and Bottom Feeders. So if you want to be the first to know about those, definitely follow me on social.
Well, Ezra, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. And I cannot wait to pick up my copy of Bottom Feeders for sure. And Upgrade Soul was an absolute pleasure to read. So thank you very much, man.
Awesome. Thanks so much for talking.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast, Barron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barron Space production.